The Legislative Council considered four bills at its sitting last week, including bills covering gambling legislation, public records, income tax and employment. And to bring these bills alive, I'm joined in the studio by MLC's Gary Cluett and Tanya August-Phillips.
Well, the gambling industry represents something like 17% of the economy of the Isle of Man. So it is systemically very important to us, and that we get it right. One of the challenges we've got with the gambling legislation overall is that it comprises seven completely separate acts dealing with different areas of gambling that have been enacted over the past 50 years. And they've gotten horribly out of sync with each other in terms of enforcement, in terms of the way they operate, in terms of just terminology and things. And one of the things that this bill has done is consolidate an awful lot of definitions, the way the legislation is interpreted, the way it's enforced and things, is basically made it common across all of these various bills. But most importantly, we've all heard of the Moneyval assessment, which is the OECD's basically enforcement arm for money laundering and terrorist financing operations. That plus international regulations have set standards for these types of industries because they are quite high risk. In fact, I believe the Gambling Supervision Commission was it yesterday or last couple of days has released their latest risk assessment. And it's medium high. We know that there are certain trigger points in that industry that raise the profile of risk in terms of certainly overseas foreign players and various things like that.
And of course, that industry matters. Yes. Because, well, you tell us why does that gambling industry?
Well, as I say, it is a significant part of our economy. It employs a lot of very well-paid people on the island, and we have to be seen to be doing things correctly. We've had, there've been one or two scandals in the last year or so over gaming companies, and international regulators are looking at that very, very closely. One of the things that came out of our 2016 Moneyval evaluation was specifically around our gaming industry. Other jurisdictions that have gambling, who have in the last several years been subject to Moneyval assessments, have also had a very sharp focus on that industry. So it is very important that we bring our legislation in line with the international standards before we get to that assessment.
So with the Moneyval inspection happening imminently, Tanya, why did you introduce a kind of a delay into the process?
I don't think it necessarily needs to be a delay. I mean, at the end of the day, we could always suspend standing orders in Legislative Council and take clauses and final in the same sitting. I think that the evidence, the reason why I asked for an evidence stage in Legislative Council to take evidence from the FSA and the GSC heads and their various, their respective policy officers, is because we're waiting. There are two pieces to the sort of Moneyval puzzle. The main sort of two bits of legislation is the FSA legislation and the GSC legislation. We were expecting to see those probably at the very latest January time, and now we're sort of like swinging towards March. So they are coming at a later stage than they were originally planned. Both have been subject to quite considerable consultation with industry and have been changed off the back of that consultation with industry. GSC, we are actually looking at, because we have it in front of us, it's in the branch. The FSA, we don't have sight of at the moment at all. It's still sat with that regulator. There are two sort of main elements, but there are other parts of both pieces of legislation that almost need to harmonise to a degree, understanding that the FSA is a much more mature regulator than the GSC is. It's been around for a considerable period of time. It's grown in strength and it is quite mature as an organisation. The GSC isn't, which is the reason why it's, bringing the legislation is coming forward in the way that it is, and the reason why the last Moneyval assessment there were quite serious please get on, legislate, make this regulator, do what it needs to do before the next Moneyval assessment, which is the reason why we have this legislation in front of us, as Gary says. Now, there are a couple of elements. So penalties regime and also AML or anti-money laundering. Now, those two pieces, I'm not suggesting that they should be merged or that, you know, we're making comparisons between two very distinctively and different industries. I'm saying that those two elements need to have some degree of parity between those two regulators to make sure that we're regulating fairly across those two industries.
And the other thing we know certainly from the finance industry is that there are, unfortunately, it's difficult to get voices to come on these radio programs, but behind closed doors, people working in the finance industry have been increasingly expressing concern that they are over-regulated.
Yes.
And on the one hand, you need to have good, relevant regulation, which the world can trust. But on the other hand, you've got to make sure that regulation doesn't stifle business, don't you?
Yeah. And there's that balance is continuously one as we're looking through these bits of legislation and where it's sort of getting documentation through to scrutinise the Moneyval preparation process. That's something that we're very, focused on. I think that there's a very, very fine line between that effect on the economy and regulating and making sure that we're regulating fairly and making use of statutory and non-statutory toolkits in order to be able to do those things. I've heard an awful lot in my time in enterprise. So I've just stepped back as a member to spend more time over in the Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture. I'm still responsible for their legislation, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But there has been considerable concern, particularly over the course of the last year from industry, about what some individuals suggest might be, over-regulation. Discretion being used that's a bit more forceful culturally than they were expecting to see. I think that, that balance does need to be struck. And the reason why I want this evidence stage is because I would like to see that balance struck between, like, with both regulators. Mm. I would like to see that balance struck and struck well and them learning from each other.
And Gary, I mean, the gambling legislation, why is that taken by a Treasury member and not DfE?
Because the regulators, both the FSA and the GSC, are part of the Treasury. They're not in DfE. And this comes back to one of the controversial aspects of the changes to the gambling legislation is that in the past, the GSC has sort of had a secondary role of promoting the industry, and that's sort of frowned upon internationally, just as a case of, well, how can you be promoting it? You're a regulator, you're supposed to be, keeping an eye on them. So that has been separated. So the regulator, the GSC itself, will no longer actively promote the industry. That function has moved over to the Department of Enterprise. So it's only the regulatory features that will stay, as with the Financial Services Administration. I have a lot of sympathy with people in the industry about over-regulation. The reality is that some of these regulations are quite onerous, but the fact is that they've become international standards. If you want to play in this space, you don't have a lot of choice. Where we're seeing some of the gaming companies that are potentially, have left the island and things, one of the problems, what the challenges with this industry is, it is incredibly mobile, especially now with a lot of mobile gaming on phones and things. You can move you can up sticks and move a company very, very easily. And what has happened is, in some cases, where we've we've reduced our risk appetite to some extent, and there are operators that maybe operate very close to the line that in some cases they find it easier to find another jurisdiction. There are other jurisdictions that are popping up on a daily or weekly basis that don't have mature regulatory regimes or just starting out, and so you can move potentially to another jurisdiction and get away with things that you can't get away with in a mature environment. So there's that, and then there's, you know, there's the other aspect we've heard from industry and things. They're concerned about the penalties regime. Well, quite frankly, we are playing catch up, and we will still be playing catch up. I mean, we've introduced a penalties regime. We do not have criminalized anything yet. There are other jurisdictions that have. There are other jurisdictions that have had these penalty regimes for 20 years. So, you know, it really is us getting more parity with some of the more regulated players. And I think in actual fact, what I've heard is that the fact that we are seen increasingly as a first class premier jurisdiction, that there are players in the industry who need that and are more attracted to this. So, you know, we will lose some over time, and we will hopefully gain some.
Things. Well, we're almost halfway through the programme, and we've got three more bills to cover. So the Public Records Amendment Bill, Tanya, that's your one.
I think we've talked about this before, though, haven't we?
Yes, but we haven't talked about Gary's amendments.
No, we haven't.
But
no.
tell us briefly what the bill does.
So it improves the preservation of public records and makes them more transparent by reducing the time frame that they are kept for. I'll leave it probably to Gary to explain what his amendments are, though. Essentially, the preservation of public records, it improves the preservation of public records, providing that the records of historic significance would be transferred to the Public Records Office 5 years earlier than the current provisions, which sit at 20 years at the moment. And then also adds additional public bodies that are covered, the records are covered by the Public Records Act, ensuring historically significant records of these public bodies can be preserved. And the bill improves access to public records as well by introducing the standard closure period for public records. So that currently sits at 30 years and is now going down to 25 years.
And Gary, one of your amendments was basically looking at those records that under the bill as drafted could have remained permanently excluded from public vision, and you're looking for a greater test on that.
Yes, I think most of mine would tidy up amendments to ensure that there's not overreach, because there's a slight complication. There's two aspects of this. There's the Public Records Act, and then there's the Freedom of Information Act, and this bill sort of amended both of those, and there were a couple of areas where it seemed to be. At least in my view, that there were grey areas where things could remain sealed without justification. And I'm always wary of, you know, taking the default action as, well, we're not going to release anything. There are mechanisms available where you can redact certain information. And, you know, there clearly there is some information that does need to remain closed. One of the other areas in one of my amendments was to better define things like distress. And I know I think Mr. Crane had questions over, well, you know, how can you say a rape thing is never distressful? And it was more to do with the amendment only affected records that were closed for 84 years and 100 years. And what I wanted to do was make sure that researchers coming down the right. Yeah, clearly, if you're talking about certain crimes and things, if there are victims, there are families, relatives, or whatever, there's distress, and that would still be covered. However, there are also cases, historic cases where there are no victims anymore. They're no longer living. There's no family. Mm. Where researchers need to get in to be able to uncover and look at and track back things. So that was part of the other thing. And then it was really just to also to clarify to some extent the difference between the, you know, public disclosure and the FOI regimes in terms of the slight conflict and perceived differences in those two. So,
and generally speaking, when we see an income tax bill, we're not entirely happy about it. But this is probably good news for most of us in that it helps Treasury gain extra funding.
Yes, probably not a popular approach, but no, we've had this. We have these things called temporary taxation orders that are used every single year around budget. It allows the Treasury to immediately for bills and monetary items that come and are approved by Tynwald to have immediate effect, and they're done through a temporary taxation order.
Because if you were going to move a bill to make it an act of Tynwald directly after the budget, you could be six months before provisions in the budget could come into force.
Yes, at least. So this gives a way of making something formal and official immediately, but it comes with a string attached, which is that so when a temporary taxation order is initially passed, it has to receive royal assent within 24 months, otherwise it ceases to exist. But in that 24 months, it has to be read for a second time within 12 months. So what we're doing with this particular bill, which went through Keys and now is in Legislative Council, is confirming decisions that were taken by Tynwald last year. Mm. And this was for the changes to the tax cap, the changes to the personal allowances that came in last year, and several other minor amendments and tidy ups of the Income Tax Act. There have been a number of concessions that have been used by the tax office for a number of years around certain matters, and it's really just putting them on a formal legal basis.
But the other big one in here, of course, is the international companies taxation, which will bring in, was it 35 million?
So the Pillar 2, which is, so a number of years ago, I think it came in first, in effect of 2024, I think it was, the Pillar 2, another OECD instrument, which requires that multinational enterprises that operate in obviously internationally, that have global revenues, profits over 750 million euros, must pay 15% of that in tax in the jurisdictions, proportional in the jurisdictions where they operate. We have a number of companies on the island, more than I had initially anticipated, that are subject to that. Our estimates, because it's new, so we haven't actually received any money yet, but it will start coming in this year. And I think we're looking at about 35 to 37 million pounds up initially, with an ongoing revenue stream of about 30 plus million pounds a year, which is very helpful to us. This came again through on a TTO. If anybody looked at the legislative calendar, we were planning on having a Pillar 2 bill come through, but it's sort of some part of it's been thrown up in the air because the United States has thrown its toys out the pram and said they're not going to participate in that. Long term, it doesn't particularly affect us. Most of the multinationals that are operating are either UK or European based. We don't have too many American based things, so it's not likely to impact us, but it may well just become a tax on that for European based companies. So the bill is in abeyance right now, so we still had to do this through a TTO, and over the next 6 months or so, we're hoping that things are more fleshed out and we get more certainty in where we're going internationally with these laws.
And then finally, we move on to the Employment Amendment Bill, which is at its close, or was had its closest stage, and that again is one that you're bringing through, Tanya.
Yes, it is. Like I said, I'm still responsible for the department's legislative programme. So this is another one of the bills that we've got coming through that sort of addresses our employment framework and modernisation of it. Something that's sort of, you know, over the course of this administration, we've been attempting to improve as much as we can by the end of it. This bill sort of centres on two different areas, being carers leave and neonatal care leave. Both sort of support the wider government priority in helping people who need it most by strengthening, you know, the island's appeal and you know, where we are, where we live, where we work. Earlier in the administration, we have amended the Employment Act to introduce the right to parental bereavement leave. That's been in place for working families since November 2024. But essentially, the bill sets out sort of that two-pronged approach with carers' leave. Firstly, a minimum of 1 week for short-term leave each year, and a longer-term option for those that have more intensive caring duties. And there are clauses that sort of detail that a person might qualify for carer's leave if they care for a dependent who is a spouse, a civil partner, child, grandchild, parent, grandparent, friend as well. So pretty much covers, like, you know, most situations. And, you know, that sort of definition of those relationships. But a friend is obviously sort of including a much wider coverage there. The bill also defines what counts as a long-term care need as well, including illnesses, injury that might be physical, mental, that people might require care for more than 3 months. Neonatal care leave, another new category of leave that would provide statutory leave to parents and children who are admitted to neonatal care. Although we do have the neonatal admissions on the island are thankfully reasonably low. The intention is to ensure, though, that parents can extend their parental leave for a period directly linked to the length of the baby's time in neonatal care. And that mirrors the approach that's taken in England, Scotland and Wales. And it's something that we've spent an awful lot of time in department workshopping with political members, with officers, and also with sort of gathering evidence from Manx Care as well, in trying to strike the right balance and make sure that it's right for the Isle of Man, as opposed to just sort of picking up the English approach. We've looked at other approaches as well and sort of benchmarks, but the approach in England, Scotland and Wales sort of makes an awful lot of sense, and it's strongly supported by organisations like Bliss, which is the leading UK charity for premature and sick babies.
And of course, for people who are a little concerned that effectively the businesses are going to end up having to pay for this, I suppose the issue there is that company tax on the Isle of Man is negligible, and somehow we have to pay for all these caring services. It's an awful lot cheaper, I imagine, if someone can take a little bit of time off work to care for someone than having to go into full-blown care provided by the state. So I imagine in most cases people will get that and understand that, but there will be potentially, you know, small businesses that are heavily reliant on all their staff, and this will come with some level of impact on those, won't it?
We have received an awful lot of support, actually, from employers. So I've got to be fair to those that have actually contacted and consulted with us. They've been very, very supportive. We've still got an awful lot more to do in terms of engaging with them on the practicalities of the regulations to make sure that we have a balanced framework as well. So it's, you know, I don't think that's in any way ended. We're going to keep having those conversations with the intention is to have those conversations with employers and to keep employers very much involved in this process.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the challenges with some of the very small businesses, if they even willing, you know, if you have somebody that takes off 2 or 3 months and you've only got 2 or 3 people on staff, it's very difficult to find a short-term replacement. And so it can be disruptive.
I suppose then that comes, well, I briefly alluded there to the fact that company tax on the Isle of Man is negligible. Is there any, because at one point in a iteration at least of the Our Ireland plan, there was talk of a fairer taxation system. Is there any chance that that might happen? And we've left that with just a minute left till the end of the programme to drop in.
Certainly not this administration. But it is something that does need to be looked at. We have increasing costs across government and healthcare specifically, and we are going to have to evaluate that in terms of how much money we raise.
Tanya?
Can I also just add in, though, that regarding this particular bill, that regarding carers leave, it is intended that the tier one approach to carers leave, so that the right to short-term carers leave, would be unpaid by the employer. But Treasury has provided agreement in principle that it should be should the eligibility of carers leave match closely to that of carers allowance, then amendments could be made to existing social security legislation to enable eligible individuals to access carers allowance during the longer term leave. So that, you know, that allowance is already administered by Treasury and would serve as a temporary income support mechanism for individuals who suspend their employment to take full-time caring responsibilities with carers leave. And separately, with neonatal leave, Treasury concurrence has also been granted to explore how a social security allowance could be implemented to support the period to limit barriers to access there as well. So there are things that conversations that are sort of happening and are taking place across government as well to make sure that we make this a fair system for everybody.
That was MLC's Gary Cluett and Tanya August Phillips. So what do you think? E-gaming represents a big part of our economy, so it's important Tinwell gets regulation right, I guess. And what's not to like about cementing income tax rules so that large international companies based here pay a bit back to fund government services? For now, I'm Phil Gawne. Goedemorgen, Geisha Krom. Thanks for listening.